Well, thank you all for coming this afternoon. Our class is called Sacrament of Friendship, Creating Safe Places for Deep Theological Conversation. I'm Aaron Metcalf. I'm the preaching minister at Westside Church of Christ in Beaverton, Oregon.
I'm Darren Reese, director of Global Ministries at Highland Church of Christ.
I'm Mark Weeb. I teach theology and philosophy at Lubbock Christian. I preach part-time at a little church in Gale, Texas.
And I'm Ben Reese, preaching minister at Federal Way Church of Christ in Federal Way, Washington.
Yesterday, we talked a little bit about our journey together, and then we kind of shared two theological concepts that have kind of grown out of our time together. Basically, we have been friends since graduate school at Abilene Christian University, and kind of on a dare from our wives, began getting together every single year. They said we couldn't do it, and we showed them wrong. And it started off with us just kind of wanting to be buddies and hang out. We just enjoyed being around each other. But what we didn't know then was how much we would truly need each other over the next 10 years of ministry. And so our times together, we do a yearly retreat. Our times together have grown into what we can identify as a sacrament, kind of an outward sign of an inward grace or gift from God that we feel together. We legitimately receive one another as a gift from God when we're together. And these times have really been good for us, informative for us, and actually shaped the way that we approach our individual ministries. Which is something I want to talk a little bit. We want to talk a little bit more about today. So they've been formational for us in our ministries. So yesterday we talked about the role that doubt has played in our times together and what it's meant to be walking with one another through seasons of intense doubt, which is kind of a part of the life of faith. And then we also talked about eschatology and the role that kind of the end times and pictures of wholeness that God has for us are lived out and expressed in our times together. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the really powerful role that prayer has taken in our time together, and also talk about how we talk about God and divine agency and what God does or doesn't do if he or she exists together. So Ben's going to lead us through prayer.
One of the significant themes that I think we touched on yesterday that will come out in my reflections on our the time we pray together is the significance of us being able to be fully open and honest with one another. That there's no pretension, there's no need to project something we're not to one another, that we're able to each accept one another and all of the good and the ugly and the bad, and how rare that is. I think in churches and for ministers, but also I think when it comes to prayer, how easy it is to project to God in the midst of others a false self or hide things or try to hide things from God. One of the things that we do when we gather at these retreats is we each take time to reflect on how the last year has been, where we're at. And it takes 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes as one person shares and the other three listen. And it tends to move towards questions as the other three listen. But it always ends with a time of prayer with one another, where we surround the one who just finished sharing, and we lay hands on the person, and then we pray over them. And I want to speak kind of autobiographically, and I'm guessing this will resonate with Mark, Darren, and Aaron. I'll let them nuance from their own perspective. But for me, prayer is a kind of tricky thing. Like, most days I'm not sure how it functions or if it works. I have, at times, my prayer life mostly is silent because I don't really know what to say. For me, in my experience, it seems that the same amount of people are healed whether they're prayed for or they're not. The same amount of people die whether or not they're prayed for or not. So, confessionally, like, I'm not exactly sure all the time how prayer functions. And when I pray publicly, To be completely honest, it's typically a projection of what I hope other people will see in me. That I'm projecting a self that, you know, I think the congregation should hope and want for in their minister. So that's kind of, let me ask you guys to respond just to that. Is that, does that resonate? How would you want to nuance it? Great. Okay, moving on.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm sure it's always,
did you come to our church?
I think that, you know, we use this word a lot, being vulnerable and being intimate with each other, and how difficult that is in our time period, especially for men. It's not something that comes naturally to us. Love what Mark said yesterday about it being a virtue, meaning it's not something that comes naturally to us. It's something we have to practice. And praying together is definitely a practice that we do that, for me, is almost always the most uncomfortable part of it. I mean, I really don't enjoy having people put their hands on me and pray over me. Part of that's just because I don't really like being, you know, touched or anything. But there's this vulnerability when people are reaching out to God on behalf of you. And the prayers will often go on for a while, depending on how crummy you're doing. Some years it just lies, so the prayers will go, God, thank you for Aaron.
And there's, I think I definitely agree with you. And that's what's been fun over the years, to see when different ones of us have had those times where prayer really was hard. And so the fact that others could pray for you, but really more than that, the fact that we could say that, like, I don't really pray these days. And nobody goes, oh my goodness. You know, it was a safe place to share that. And so, yeah, definitely resonate with what you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that all of us have in common, I think, that's come out over the years is that we all struggle to understand prayer. We all struggle to practice prayer. I know I feel sometimes when I'm praying in church or whatever, I feel sort of fraudulent. Like, I'm saying what I think people expect me to say. You know, I'm reading a script. And that's because if I'm honest, I've never really fully understood prayer. It's never been a really comfortable thing. And it's these retreats, this practicing this, even through the discomfort of it, has been really important. I think part of my spiritual development, even that it's an environment where it's safe to have awkward prayers, and difficult prayers, to not know what to say exactly. I think that's been crucial.
I love that, awkward prayers. Yeah. You know what's funny, reflecting real quick too, it's even in my worst times where I'm having a hard time praying, I never have a hard time praying for somebody else.
Yeah.
Like if it's my turn and I'm praying, you know, we all pray for each other. I don't remember that being like an issue, which is interesting.
Yeah. So Frederick Buechner has this great quote. This is from The Magnificent Defeat. He says, "In honesty, you have to admit to a wise person that prayer is not for the wise, it's not for the prudent, it's not for the sophisticated. Instead, it is for those who recognize that in the face of their deepest needs, all their wisdom is quite helpless. It is for those who are willing to persist in doing something that is both childish and crucial." And I really, really like that. And I think for us, the time of prayer becomes this communal confession with and for one another, that we are inadequate. And in spite of massive seasons of persistent doubt, can you have a persistent season? Besides seasons of doubt, that this confession with and for one another, that we are inadequate, even all of the gifts that we bring, which are a lot of gifts, is really, really significant. So we gather and we pray over the person, I want to just offer a few reflections on both praying over and then being prayed for. That, as already been hinted, in those moments, we're honest. You know, there's been plenty of times that we've expressed profound anger at God. There's been plenty of times where we've expressed profound joy and thanksgiving. Right? We've prayed for each other's families and ministry contexts. And in those moments, even though we have heard from one another that we're loved, even though we've heard from one another that we are God's beloved, even though we've spoken words of forgiveness, there's something about actually praying that moves it into a communal confession that brings to life a faith that maybe wasn't there before. So there's a difference between me telling Mark, I love you, and you're God's beloved, and those times when we gather around him and we pray over him. But there's something about that communal act of prayer that makes the time a little bit more tangible. And I don't know if I'm making any sense to anybody. And in those moments of prayer, I'm pretty confident that my prayers, I'm lukewarm that my prayers.
I have a punch.
I'm not sure how my prayers affect anything. In that, something happens as a result of my prayer, but I am convinced, I am very confident that in prayer, I become far more aware that God is active, if that makes sense. That God's activity isn't inherently a result of what I pray, but prayer becomes the space where I recognize and experience that, oh, God is active. So Randy tells this great joke, and I was going to claim it for my own, but he's here, so I have to give it to
him. I had like four stories I was going to share. Yeah.
So there's this young man who's dating the daughter of a Quaker, and he figures he's a Quaker, he's nonviolent, and so no matter what I do, he won't hurt a hair on my head. He doesn't treat the daughter well. The Quaker father confronts him on this, and he says, "Now I'd like to remind you that you are a Quaker, you are nonviolent, you cannot hurt a hair on my head." And the father replies with, "You're right, I am a Quaker, I am nonviolent, I would never hurt a hair on your head, but you need to know that you're standing where I'm about to shoot my gun." and that prayer and spiritual disciplines and practices and virtues in many ways is that. It's putting yourself in the place to experience God, to put yourself in the place of God's path. And so those moments in which we're praying over one another, for me, are moments in which I'm forced to articulate and proclaim and even experience that, oh, God is up to something, that God is active. Being prayed over, as Aaron's already said, is miserable. Like, we avoid that like the plague.
It's like this. When it's your turn to be prayed over, you go like this.
Oh, yeah, it's okay. Miserable, yeah. But here's the thing about those moments. Like, you actually get to hear trusted voices.
Hold it together.
Thanks, dude. That was close. I lost $5 yesterday because I cried first. I'm not losing it today.
Parts are our emotional spot.
Yeah, I can. Whoa, you're losing it. You get to hear trusted voices speak honestly about who you are as God's beloved, forgiven, beautiful child. I love, you know, the Christ hymn for me is one of my favorite texts out of Philippians 2, and it's become that way because I love the, I can't even remember it. How's it go, Mark?
Children obey your parents.
Children obey your parents for Your attitude should be the same as Christ, who didn't consider equality with God. And being found in human form, he emptied himself, right? Made himself a slave. That it isn't in spite of Jesus' humanity that he empties himself, but that to be fully human, Jesus is let me say it again. Jesus is the fullest embodiment of what it means to be human, right? And so are we sinners? Are we a mess? Absolutely. But we're also beloved children of God. And to hear and to have people pray over you that you trust, that even when you're so convinced within your own identity and sense of yourself, that you're not actually forgiven or beloved or have anything to offer, there's, for me, in those moments, I hear a word of identity and I could trust them because they've been there for me and they've heard it all. I don't know, what do you guys think? Don't cry. So I'm not going to.
You know, I think I want to say quickly too, one of the things we've learned over the years, and this is something Randy has certainly taught me, don't ever be afraid of silence during prayers.
Yeah.
And even when we're sharing together, there's been times where there's just been long periods of silence. And there just needs to be this kind of space. Because words just don't need to happen, you know. And I think that's been important for us. You don't have to fill the prayer with a bunch of words. The other thing that I think is hard for me on an individual level, when I'm being prayed over, especially during seasons of doubt and depression that I've gone through, it's just hard to believe it.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of will yourself to say, we went to a great class today by Leland Howell, who was talking about his journeys with depression, and allowing your faith to be carried by other people, allowing them to speak into your life, is just not as easy as it sounds. Because it can be hard to say, okay, I'm just going to rely on my community, on my friends to speak into my life, even when I don't believe it. And I don't believe the stuff that they're saying right now. It can be a challenge to kind of, I don't know, open yourself up to that, put yourself in the way of it.
One thing that strikes me about what you were saying about the way that prayer connects us in ways that we can't connect to each other immediately is something Dietrich Bonhoeffer says when he's talking about prayer in Life Together. He says that we always want to have an immediate connection to the people around us. But he says that our relationships are not immediate. They're not supposed to be immediate. They're supposed to be mediated. Mm-hmm. And so that's where he says the prayer becomes crucial. I grew up sort of thinking that prayer was sort of pointless. It's not really helpful for me to go up to somebody and say, I'll pray for you. But I think, to just say that.
Yeah.
But I think Bonhoeffer would say, yeah, that's the most important thing because that's the first way that you connect to your neighbor. I was in one of my classes, in my philosophy class, we were reading an article on the question of the meaning of life. And the guy was, I can't remember the author, but he was
Joel Osteen.
Oprah.
Wait, we want to guess. We'll get it eventually. But he was comparing, he went to the perfect example of meaninglessness, which is the story of Sisyphus, right? He rolls a rock up a hill, goes back down over and over again. He's just condemned to an eternity of pointless, endless labor, right? No end and no point, no progress, nothing happens as a result of this. And so the author was using that as a template and comparing it to some contemporary examples that he could think of. And he was thinking of one of the examples he provided was of a group of nuns in a monastery who spend all day long chanting these prayers over and over and over again for decades, decade after decade after decade. And so that was his example of the most Sisyphean task. And then he compared that to the rest of of life and other types of lives that people live. And I was also reading Bonhoeffer in another class, and I was sort of thinking of the two of them together and what Bonhoeffer would say in response. I think he would say the nuns are not leading useless, empty lives. They are, that's precisely how you connect to your neighbor, is by connecting to Christ. Is that your connection to your neighbor is not immediate, it's mediated. And that happens through prayer. And I've seen that in really profound ways in our prayers together.
Yeah, I remember, and there was a season there where I used the language of, you know, there's a time I wrestled with seeming absence of God, and that created anxiety, and then, okay, God kind of with the anxiety, that was okay with the silence, and so then there's a period where I always said, you know, God and I had a truce. And that was sort of, that was kind of as good as I could get. Wasn't mad, wasn't anxious, but I didn't really know what to do with it. So we were, it was a couple of years there, I think, in Thailand.
Just leave each other alone for a while.
Yeah, it's like, this is better if we just,
I will cut out for you.
Yeah. And, but those times of being together, having others pray for me, and being forced to pray for them, and in the midst of this group, because of the experience we had shared, I couldn't fake that prayer for them. And so, by having that practice, it forced me to call off the truce, because I wasn't going to offer a prayer for these guys in the midst of what they just shared, the vulnerability, and be fake. And so, the fact that practice is in our time together, I think it pulled me out of that and reconnecting to God, because too much was at stake in that moment praying for them.
Well said. You know, several people have asked, like, how can we build these sorts of relationships? And I think it's that commitment to vulnerability is big. But I also think the commitment to prayer and inviting God in is huge, because if it is going to be sacramental, if it is going to be a grace, it has to be explicitly, you know, spiritual. We're allowing God to come in this space in an overt way, which can often feel awkward. You know, we're four pretty tough, burly dudes. You know, or three pretty tough, burly dudes.
No offense. No offense.
Speaking of God.
Oh, yeah.
So yesterday I mentioned some of the things that really captured my thinking when I was preparing for this.
Do you have footnotes? You have footnotes.
I pointed out to Mark, I love the progression. Aaron started with nothing written down.
No, I wrote down a one page doubt.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, doubt. Darren had a note card. I have a moleskin. Mark has the iPad. It's a program.
I don't know if they revealed my. We've all got nicknames, and mine is the obsessor.
Because he obsesses.
Anyway, I'm not going to read it, I promise. So one thing that has really captured my thinking over the last half decade has been the heritage of Christian thought, especially as it is mediated through scholasticism and in particular through Thomas Aquinas. I've really found his deep devotion and his faith and his using his mind to love God to be profoundly life-changing to me. And so that's one of the things that I'm going to be reflecting on. As I said yesterday, let me start here. A lot of people think that in certain circles of contemporary theology, they have this sort of stereotype of what's called classical theism, and that would include people like Aquinas and Augustine and a lot of the church fathers and so on. And there's this sort of picture of God as stoic and remote and distant and impassive, apathetic almost. And it, the way that Augustine and Thomas, for example, describe God is that couldn't be further from the truth. And as I said yesterday, along these lines, the primary framework that Thomas uses for thinking about every aspect of his theology, from his doctrine of God to his doctrine of creation, incarnation, atonement, eschatology, ecclesiology, pneumatology. All of it is shaped by the language of friendship. And that that I think is something we need to reflect on. And I think some of the insights the authors are really important. Let me start with a quote from somebody else who loves Thomas Aquinas, which would be Thomas Merton. He said, "A happiness that is sought for ourselves alone can never be found. For a happiness that is diminished by being shared is not big enough to make us happy." Now he's channeling Augustine there. Augustine said that the highest things, the most valuable things, you can identify them in a very simple way. If you give them away and you don't have less of them, then they're really valuable. Right? And there aren't many things that are like that. If I give money away, I have less of it. If I give a car away, I have one less car. And so on. But, and so for Augustine, he would say, well, that means that that's not really one of the highest goods. That's something that's not really deeply valuable. Something that can't possibly really make me happy, in other words. Help me to live a full life. The things that you can give away and not lose would be things like love and friendship. If I give friendship away, I don't have less of it, I have more of it. Right? So friendship and love, these are non-competitive goods, that's one way of describing it. And this is what Thomas Merton is saying. A happiness that is sought for ourselves alone can never be found. For a happiness that is diminished by being shared is not big enough to make us happy. And that line of thinking, going back through this broad, rich Christian heritage, has really shaped my thinking. And it goes back to Aristotle. Aristotle, one of the things that stands out about Aristotle is that when he's reflecting on ethics, he spends this extraordinary, strangely extraordinary amount of time talking about friendship. He spends 2 books out of 10 in the Nicomachean Ethics talking about friendship, about the nature of friendship, what it involves, what it looks like, and so on. And you never really see that in contemporary moral philosophy. You don't see extended, reflective, analytical treatments of the notion of friendship. And that tells us something about, I think, the way that we tend to view friendship. Friendship is, we see it as a clear, lucid concept. We also see it as something that's sort of mundane and private. But for Aristotle, it was crucial to a truly just society. That's why he spent so much time on it. In fact, that's the climax, very close to the end of the Ethics. He reflects on friendship because he says that a society that's built on friendship actually doesn't even need coercive justice because of the nature of friendship. Because friends' wills are aimed in the same direction. And so you don't need external forces compelling people to get along. You don't need external force to get friends to get along. They're friends, right? Their wills are aimed in the same direction. And so for Aristotle, that's the smallest element, the smallest constituent of a truly just society, is friendship. And so it's really, really crucial for Aristotle. In fact, he thinks that isolation is literally dehumanizing. To not have friends, to be isolated, is to be dehumanized, quite literally, for Aristotle. And so this is a really, really important concept for Aristotle, and I think the amount of ink that he spends on friendship should, by itself, lead us to pause and consider what friendship looks like. So what Aristotle says, and this is the line of thinking that in turn shapes people like Thomas Aquinas and then several 20th century theologians, Aristotle says that friendship involves three crucial things. One is, the first and the most important, is benevolence. Willing the good for the other. Now, he contrasts that with two other types of things that to which we would want to pin the label friendship. One other thing that you might want to call friendship would be what he describes as a friendship of utility. So the obvious example would be like a business transaction. I enter into a relationship with you because I gain something from you. It's sort of like a trade, right? It's a useful relationship, which is the word utility, right? So that's one thing, one type of thing that we might call friendship. Friendship of utility. Another is friendship based on pleasure, which is sort of the same thing, but he distinguishes them. It's a friendship, a relationship that is based in the fact that I gain pleasure from it. Right? I'm pleased by it in some way or another. But what Aristotle says is that those aren't actually genuine friendship. They're not the genuine article. Real friendship is not connection to another person for the sake of something that I can get out of it. It's not connection based on how useful you are or how productive you are. But it's valuing you, willing your good for your sake, because you are valuable. Not because of anything I get out of you, not because of the pleasure I get or how useful you are or whatever. And so that's literally what benevolence means. It's good will, good volition, willing that the other person gain some good. And I think a good, maybe this will be the only time that we actually connect to James, but...
were we supposed to?
I didn't get that.
Oh, James' theme, I forgot.
So you can see a nice contrast between the guy in James, I think it's 2:15, where he's talking about how if you go up to somebody, if you see somebody who doesn't have any clothes or food or whatever, and you just say, "Be well. I hope you make it," or whatever. I can't remember how to phrase it.
That was it.
It's in the Bible.
It's in the Bible. Don't try to go there.
You know the passage I'm talking about, and that's, I think it's a nice contrast between that and a story in Luke 10, which has just captured my attention for several years now. It's always in the back of my mind. This really powerful story of a mugging on the side of the road. A Jewish man going to Jericho, and he gets mugged, and he's beaten half to death, and he's lying naked, and in the ditch, right? And the priest goes by, and you can imagine him saying exactly those words, the words that James says, right? He's like standing against the other side of the road, as far away as he can get, and he's saying, "Be well. I hope you make it."
We'll call that priest Aaron.
Right, and then the Levite comes by, and then the Samaritan comes by. Now, this story is in response to a question that never gets answered. Right, the guy comes up to Jesus, and he says, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus never answered that question. Instead, he says, "That's the wrong question. You misunderstand what it is to be a... you misunderstand the word neighbor. Neighbor is not something you find in somebody else. It's not some quality. It's not some worthiness. It's not some merit that you encounter in the other. It's something that you do. It's something that you are. You are a neighbor." Right? That's the question he asks at the end of the story. Who was a neighbor to this man? Right? It's active. It's willing the good. Not just desiring the good. Right? Not just wishing that the other person will succeed or get out of the rut that they're in or whatever it is. But actually willing the good for the other's sake. Right? The Samaritan's not getting anything from this guy. He's not, this Jewish man is not useful. I'm assuming he's not pleasing in any way to the Samaritan. But he wills the good for him. He actually acts. He's inclined towards this other person's good. I'm going to have to speed it up here.
He's so smart. I see why we bring him on the trips. It's fun just to wind him up a little bit.
The second quality, the second
property of friendship for Aristotle is, and this I think is really crucial for us Protestants to hear, and it's really important for Thomas Aquinas as well when he's thinking about atonement and soteriology, and that is mutuality. Friendship is not unidirectional goodwill. It is mutual goodwill. I love what C.S. Lewis says about charity in Mere Christianity. He talks about, he contrasts the contemporary meaning and use of the word charity with the classical use of the word charity. The modern meaning of the word charity is, I mean, you could, it's sort of like handing down to the other, right? You are over them, you are giving, you are the have, and they are the have not, and you give down to them, and they remain other. It's never a mutual relationship. Whereas the classical definition of charity is, I mean, that's the word for love, that's the Latin word for love that's in the Latin version of the Bible. And for Thomas, that's where friendship becomes, the concept of friendship becomes crucial. We can't just think about love in these sort of general terms. We have to think about it very carefully, think about what it does and should involve. And for Aristotle and then for Thomas, love, the love of friendship in particular, must be mutual. It can't just be one-sided. And then finally, it involves communion. It involves unity. That's what love is for Aristotle. In fact, he says, one of the ways that Aristotle talks about friendship is seeing the other as another self. Love and friendship in particular is a type of unity. And the way that, one of the things that Aristotle says is that he refers to this old proverb about how friends are those who've eaten a bushel of salt together. It sounds really weird, but what he's saying is they've eaten
that count? Potato chips? Yeah. Easily happens the first day.
Yeah, exactly. But he's saying that friends are those who spend enough time together, they've eaten enough meals together to have consumed this massive amount of salt together. And I think that has, again, that's, you can see some wonderful implications for the way that Christian community should function. If friendship involves time, it involves commitment. This inclination towards the other that's rooted in goodwill towards the other for the other's sake. I'll just sort of stop there. I'm using up all the time.
Thanks, Mark. The other aspect of this I want to touch on is somebody was asking yesterday, you know, has anything ever threatened your friendship? And, we quickly said no, and then I thought, you know what's interesting is we have had significant conflict during our times together.
Yeah.
There's been angry words, and there's been debates that go late into the night. The Calvinist.
Do not play stage with this guy.
My nickname is the offender, and which I do very well, and I have stepped over bounds and over offended at times, which is a huge shock to people who know me. And there's been those sorts of trauma, and I think that as we're thinking about this benevolence and charity and this kind of mutuality of wills, there is also in the vulnerability, opening yourself up to allowing for that conflict to take place, and allowing for words of forgiveness to take place. This is within any relationship, but I don't know. You guys want to reflect on that a little bit?
I think that's a really important point. And that's, I keep citing my sources here, but Bonhoeffer, when he talks about love, and he contrasts what he describes as merely human love with what he describes as spiritual love. And he says that merely human love is really just desire. That I enter into a relationship with you because you fulfill some desire of mine. And then basically what Aristotle is describing as the friendship of utility or pleasure. And insofar as you fail to meet my desire, I can't be friends with you. Right? And so that would mean that I can never be friends with somebody who disagrees with me or who is my enemy. They could never be my friend, because my enemy is precisely, by definition, the person who never does anything that I want, right? They never fulfill any of my desires. I think this is where thinking of friendship in terms of the will and not just in terms of these superficial likings and agreements and uniformity is really important.
Yeah, and it reminds me of joking about debating. I mean, we all have deep theological debates while we're there, but Mark and I especially have this ongoing conversation about the doctrine of God and divine agency, which he knows nothing about, obviously. We're not above, you know, caricaturing each other, because his other nickname that I like to call him is the Calvinist,
which really makes him.
Oh man! Yeah. So look at it.
His bottom lip starts to shake.
Yeah, that's right.
And then 3 hours later, he'll go, "Guys, I just need to clarify, I'm not a Calvinist."
It's really important.
No,
you don't
Calvin
or
not Calvin. We know.
Yeah, but we got this.
I need some new friends.
You do. But it just turned into where we email each other. Well, we'll email even back and forth, because when it comes down to it, we're not that far apart. But yet, we even have a different doctrine of God, and we can go back and forth and disagree. But that act of disagreeing, but having that common union of wills in the midst of that disagreement, draws us closer and closer to God, even if we're coming at it using different language. And that has been such a fruitful thing. And Mark, with the way he, you know, can connect us to Aristotle and Christian tradition, really is a way where he roots me as I go off thinking crazily. But that, to have him, you know, drawing me back and me, us, that back and forth, but knowing that this is actually creating deeper friendship and connection to God with all of us.
And connection to God is a constant theme in each of our speeches. Darren, or when we take turns sharing, Darren started doing this years ago, and it just drives me nuts when he does it. But at the end of our sharing time, he always comes and says, "So what's up with God? What are you thinking about God?"
Yeah.
You know? And it's good for us to explicitly say, you know, often we're like, you know, well, no, I haven't thought about it in a while. That's interesting. And then it will kind of bring out deeper theological reflection that will happen after our times of sharing. And wrestling with God and kind of trying out new things we're thinking about God is creating a safe place for that. For me, has been so fruitful. Kind of coming out with everybody's experiences with where they are with God. We all have experienced God in very different ways in our various fields. It's been healthy.
So we only have two or three minutes left, and I wonder if we couldn't kind of here's some possibilities of how to nurture or develop this kind of relationship. So I'm going to offer a few, and then if you guys want to, that'd be great. Let me first say this. Jocelyn highlighted this, and I think this is really, really important, is that we come to this from a very, very privileged position. And that needs to be stated, that the four of us are both incredibly fortunate to be in vocations that allow for this kind of time and space and friendship, that there are more than enough people in the world and even in ministry who don't have this kind of time and space. Secondly, the fact that we're all men is a privilege, that we have benefactors who'd be willing to pay for our retreats together that don't exist for women in ministry, or maybe more limited. That I think it's important to say that we know this is a privilege, and we come from a very privileged position. Connected to that, I think it's really important to note that this is also a gift, that there's not like a 5-step program to develop best friends that could be honest and challenge one another. That first and foremost, we receive this as a gift, that we've done a few things here and there to nurture it, but by and large, by and large, it is a gift that we can't explain, that we can't manage, that we can't build. It's a gift from God, of which we're thankful. Finally, and then I'll let you guys throw out possible suggestions. The more that you could find a friend that you could risk being vulnerable and honest with, even if it's just a little bit. Once the two of you or three of you or four of you can get through that and realize we're okay, we didn't die, you're able to risk a little bit more the next time. That really, we are far more honest with each other now than we were 10 years ago. But it's, as Mark pointed out yesterday, it's because it's a virtue, it's a practice. That we keep practice being vulnerable and honest. And we've even have moments where at the end of the retreat or end of our time together, we'll say something that we could have said at the beginning, but we didn't want to because we didn't want to risk it. So just the practice of finding friends that you can trust, even in the smallest way, and it gives you a little bit of sense of, okay, we could do this again. Those are things I would highlight. I don't know if you guys would want to throw in others.
I think it's always going to involve risk.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's, in some ways, our title is misleading because I don't think there's ever such thing as a truly always safe space.
Yeah.
Because it's always going to take risk. In some sense, I think it has to take risk because that's how you open yourself up for change. So, you know, be careful. Some people aren't safe, and that can hurt really badly, you know.
And I think it's also good to say it's not really about developing relationships where you can go have retreats together every year. That's not really the goal. And I think, like I said, we have the privilege of this, but by creating friendship like this and having a good experience and being vulnerable and honest with one another, I think we are all more available and able to offer that to others now. And so this is, you know, this is, in fact, hopefully a way to talk, friendship is a way to talk about Christian community in general. So I think it makes us better ministers because we have received this gift that God has given us, and now to extend it to others, hopefully is a way for to kind of spread that community out, bring God in those, in other relationships as well, and to be vulnerable others in our church, and hopefully allow them to take that risk with us as well.
And I think finally, think about intentionality and space when you're cultivating these relationships. I think it's, I don't think this could happen if we were just always doing it in one of our living rooms. I think there's something to getting out, it doesn't have to be a retreat, but getting outside of your normal space through a place that feels holy, maybe. I mean, all of us really connect to God through nature, or at least I really do. So getting out to a place, you know, by a river or out in the woods for us, I think that's huge as well.
I know Aaron said finally, but I'd like to give Mark a chance to say something.
Could have said that myself. We're really grateful for you all having come out here. We know you have options, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks for choosing Delano.
Thanks.